Hi, this is Paul Gillen from Newspaper Death Watch. What follows is an interview with David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. We talked a lot about the future of investigative journalism, how new models may emerge to support professional reporters, and what he believes is the declining quality of mainstream journalism that we're seeing today. This conversation was recorded using Skype. Skype is erratic sometimes, and we had a number of dropouts in the conversation, which I've edited around in most cases, but where it was not possible to do that, I've inserted a paraphrase in my own words of the section that was deleted. So, hope you enjoy it. It runs about 24 minutes. David K. Johnston. I thought we'd just kick it off with asking you about what you think the future looks like for investigative journalism.
Well, I think that it's extremely uncertain at the moment. There is enormous demand for serious investigative reporting, but the traditional economic model is collapsing. And given the costs of investigative reporting, not just the expenditure needed to support it, but the costs faced by publishers and broadcasters with the risks that they have to take, in this environment, certainly tends to mitigate against that kind of coverage. And we're seeing less and less of it, and more of what I call faux investigative reporting, which is, you know, leaks from government agencies or material that's been spoon-fed in a way that isn't obvious to the reader or the viewer by some interest posing as an investigation.
Do you have any optimism that some new model will emerge out of this, the wreckage of the newspaper industry after this is cleared away, that will enable investigative reporting to thrive again, or are those golden days gone forever?
Well, I'm inherently an optimist. Can't have eight children and not be an optimist. So I think we will see financial models that will make this work. I'm not sure that they will provide stable incomes for journalists who do them. Another part of the problem is this fracturing of markets where, you know, there's a tremendous amount of really good investigative reporting done that very few people see, because I judge contests, including some years the annual contest of investigative reporters and editors. I've seen an astonishing quality of work by people, but that doesn't get picked up or spread or renewed. One of the models I think we're going to see for sure in the near term is the philanthropic model. ProPublica, which is run by top-flight people. The senior editor is the former longtime editor of the Wall Street Journal, and the working editor at the top there is Steve Engelberg, who was the investigative editor of the New York Times for many years and later at the Portland Oregonian. And that's work financed with gifts of money, principally in this case from the Sandlers. I think we will see more of that because there are plenty of people who care about this who have more money than they know what to do with. But that's not probably going to be adequate for the level of inquiry that's needed.
And the public financing model, a lot of people point to the PBS and the BBC as examples of how public financing can fill some of the gap. Do you think that enough money exists out there to actually, if it's focused properly, to actually bring back the kind of investigative reporting we've had in the past?
The problem with, let me deal with PBS. PBS has an economic model that is very unfortunate and compromised by a decision that went awry 40 years ago. PBS should be an incredibly vibrant a place with lots of money. But it turns out that the moneymakers for them are things they pay for that are not paid to them, because at the beginning, the people running PBS thought that Congress would generously fund this kind of activity. And instead, we've seen constant assault on it, particularly when it challenges the premises of corporate America. While you will continue to see some shows like this, it's important to recognize that because they get some money, a minority of their money for sure, but some money from government, that there is a constant focused attack by those people who do not want journalists digging into what's going on in government and corporate America. And those forces at the moment, although it doesn't always have to be that way, currently tend to come from the right that's aligned itself very tightly with corporate America. there is another possible model here, which is that Fox News and MSNBC derive a lot of money from subscriber fees that are embedded in people's monthly cable television bills. And that model, which is closer to the BBC model, where people pay a licensing fee to have a television set and a radio to fund journalism, in which the government, with a few rare and infamous exceptions, does not interfere, that is a model, I think, with a lot of potential for broadcast. But remember that most of the serious investigative work in this country is not broadcast, it's print. And there are many, many subjects that broadcast simply will never do because they're not amenable to the visual necessity of television.
If you look at the situation from a different point of view and say, well, a lot of investigative journalism, honestly, is whistleblowers. It's kicked off by whistleblowers. And there are kinds of journalism that can be done by adapting the energies of the crowd, such as monitoring political polling places or crowdsourcing coverage of events that would not have been possible a few years ago. In fact, could we come out of this with a different kind of journalism, but one that's really no less robust than the one that we're giving up?
Well, I think that this whole area of citizens as journalists is an area where there's a lot more development going to occur. There are troublesome models there, and there are incredibly valuable and useful models there. The biggest news organization in the world doesn't have a tiny fraction of the brain power and the eyes that a whole group of citizens interested in an issue can bring to it. They also, however, don't have the rigor, the training, and the ethic, the ethos that goes with the work in terms of how you deal with issues of fairness and the adequacy of documenting issues. A lot more work coming in the future from people who are not paid for the work that they are doing, and at some point that will be challenged by people who bring litigation in an effort to squash that kind of inquiry.
Is, in fact, investigative journalism the victim of market efficiency, that the luxury of being able to provide this kind of reporting, which never is supported directly by ad dollars, simply doesn't exist anymore because media organizations have to become much more efficient, and that is one of the ironies, I guess, of this whole thing. Efficient media markets are creating the casualty of good reporting.
Well, yes. I mean, newspapers began, if you go back to the beginning of newspapers, and Paul Starr wrote a brilliant book about this on the creation of the media, you know, news began as a way for the burger class and the trading class to acquire information they needed to conduct their business and also to give them some power against the predatory tendencies of the nobility. And investigative reporting, which is a relatively modern idea, who are you to question the state or someone powerful about what they're doing, is the outgrowth of an effort to profit by connecting buyers and sellers through a news medium. Now, it was a very good news medium to do that until the internet came along and reduced the costs of those transactions tremendously. And that increase in economic efficiency has been very bad for newspapers. It's not true there's no investigative reporting going on. There's a great deal. I mean, we've just seen Walt Bogdanovich of the New York Times with another series of articles, this one about radiation and people who are being killed and violation of rules and lack of enforcement. We've seen several news organizations dig up material about how the federal agency that's responsible for vehicle safety didn't have a single person on its staff who knew anything about computers in cars, and that appears to be a central issue in these 39 deaths of people who were driving Toyotas. There's still a lot of investigative reporting going on, but not nearly as much as there has been. And it is without question that the economic efficiencies of putting buyers and sellers are putting tremendous pressure on newspapers and forcing huge changes. And we've already seen there are a number of sizable cities in America now that do not have their own daily newspaper anymore because their markets aren't big enough to support commercial activity putting buyers and sellers together.
You know, if you look at the role of the newspaper as an impartial arbiter, that's actually a fairly recent development, probably.
Yes.
until about World War II, most newspaper publishers had a strong political bias, and in fact, that's what the Founding Fathers were trying to protect with the First Amendment. The impartial news media, is the importance of that concept overblown?
Well, you know, a lot of the world has party press. If you go to Europe and you read publications there, or English versions of them, they're often party press, and they promote the issues of the party. Oh, that's how we started out in this country. Remember, when the First Amendment into the Constitution, the routine of news back then was to make things up. And that's why you have Jefferson's famous quote about lies. So the you can have a society that's a democratic society with a party press. I think you're better off if you have one where the interest is not aligned with some particular faction in the society, although that's clearly where we are going here in America. I mean, we live in a society now where you can obtain a great deal of news that only reinforces those biases you have and wish to be true, and it is one of the reasons our democracy is in such trouble, is because we don't have common meeting grounds to talk about the common weal, to talk about our common interests. And that is a real threat to the continued existence of the United States of America, a very, very real threat. Whether or not we'll continue to have a commercial press that does investigative reporting where there's no bias in favor of some group, it has to do with exposing wrongdoing and conditions. And that's the really important area, is systemic problems. That's not clear. There's a market for books doing this. Most people who do these kinds of books need to have, and I certainly need to have some, other form of subsidy, lectures, magazine articles, newspaper work, to help finance the tremendous cost of them. So I don't think we're going to see investigative reporting go away. I don't think a party press means we won't have investigative reporting, but clearly there is an enormous challenge to do what the writer believes to be their best work, without kowtowing to somebody's agenda.
How big a problem is the collapsing pay rates we're seeing right now, particularly for freelance journalists?
It's awful. I just did a little freelance quickie for someone, and I realized that the pay that I received for it was less than I got in the late 1960s when you adjusted for inflation. We have a vast oversupply of writers and a vast undersupply of payable demand for them. And so you're going to see changes as a result of that, economic changes. The underlying problem to that is that a great deal of the money is not for serious work. It's for glitzmongering. Look at the kind of money that gets paid for catching some movie star with her blouse undone, or some politician in the arms of some woman, not his wife. Just frivolous nonsense, and yet there's huge money for that, and that's very reflective of one of the problems in our society, where we have gotten into away from fundamental values about the human condition that led to the creation of the United States of America, and into idol worshiping.
True enough. There are, however, advocacy organizations, well-funded advocacy organizations on all sides of the political spectrum, that have the capacity now to publish their work in a way that was never possible before. And I'm talking about environmental groups or gun owners or whoever you may think of. Could they actually become sources of quality journalism?
Well, there is some quality work done by people who have various kinds of advocacy. That tells you there's a market failure, because there are issues where there is no group that has a vested interest in doing this. And this is one of the big problems we have with Congress as well. Certainly the Sierra Club, whose editor-in-chief is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, used to be at the LA Times, Bob Sipchin, is capable of doing various kinds of serious work, but it's going to be read by the members of the Sierra Club. It's not going to be read by everybody else in the country. And that's at the core of the problem of where you have advocacy backed by various groups. And then secondly, if that's the way route we go, money talks. I'm sorry, the money in this country at the top, while not monolithic, is heavily, heavily weighted towards the right.
How about federal funding? There's been proposals for FCC type of tax that you mentioned earlier. Public funding for public media in this country is very low compared to European countries in particular. Do you think the government needs to step in and share more of the burden?
No, I don't think this is an appropriate role for government. And the reason is the only institution outside of government that is given a role in the Constitution is the press. And I define that broadly to include broadcast. And I don't think the government should be funding the press in this country. To the extent that there are tax-deductible donations to groups that do journalism, that's fine. But I don't want to see the government in the business of funding the press.
You mentioned private philanthropy earlier. Do you think there's more promise in that route?
ProPublica has been tremendously successful, and they have dug up really good stuff. It has held up. They've done first-rate work with a bunch of young people, which doesn't surprise me given the caliber of the people at the top. It's made its work widely available through the Associated Press in a deal that we announced at Investigative Reporters and Editors Annual Conference last year. Most newspapers haven't picked it up. There's been very little pickup except in specific deals they've made with specific newspapers. So when ProPublica was writing about...
We lost a few seconds of audio here. Johnston refers to a report by ProPublica late in 2009 about pollution caused from wastewater generated by natural gas drilling in Pennsylvania and New York.
The Albany Times Union ran their work, but you didn't see it run everywhere else. And they've done other investigations that were largely ignored. That's partly because many newspapers have very limited space and editors are reluctant to turn over, you know, large sections of it to some outside organization. I think we'll see more philanthropic funding of this, and that, I think, has, at least in the near term, some significant potential.
There's a lot of inefficiency in the way news is reported, in part because of what you mentioned earlier, the reluctance of editors to run stuff that they didn't create, the not invented here syndrome, overlapping jurisdictions, duplication of effort. Can we actually wring much of this inefficiency out of the process and manage to recover some of the investigative resources we've lost?
I don't think that that's inefficiency. I think one of the most valuable things that I've seen in my career is competition. When I started out as a 19-year-old reporter, there were reporters there from San Francisco and Oakland and Palo Alto and Redwood City and Sunnyvale, and there was enormous competition to get the story and to do it well. When I worked at the Los Angeles Times, where that newspaper is so dominant that it was said in the newsroom, if it didn't appear in the Times, it didn't happen, meaning anything in Southern California, there was such laziness that
some of the reporters
took to calling it jacuzzi journalism.
Yeah, I can't imagine a more arrogant attitude.
Yes, I and another reporter there in different years were each denied merit raises because we were told we were doing too much work and writing too many stories. This was a year when I did 5 investigations in 1 year and was told that this was way too much and that's why I wouldn't get a raise because I should slow down. And so my life's experience tells me that competition is vital to the quality of the news. Unfortunately, the competition that we've gotten into in recent years has been over nonsense and manufactured issues, the result of not sticking to basics. In local news, there are daily newspapers all across the country that don't send reporters to cover such basic things as the city council and the school board anymore. And yet, homeowners, what do they want to know? Well, how is the school board spending its money? What kind of policies are they enacting? And I have a collection of budget stories of county and city governments and school boards, the elected officials yelling at each other or disputing with each other, something over the budget, but no substantive coverage of is here's how much money it is, here's what it'll affect your property tax. The idea comes along that, well, we need more stories about women's fashions or how to make cupcakes, and this has been a serious mistake.
Now, you teach journalism students. And...
No, I don't teach journalism students. My students are second and third year law students at Syracuse University, Masters of Business Administration students at Syracuse University, and graduate accounting students. I've yet to have a single journalism student sign up for my courses, which would give them a base to understand the things they write about. Because one of the things that drives me crazy is every day I pick up the newspaper and I read 3 print papers a day and I look at 5 or 6 of them online, and I read articles by journalists who, well, they correctly and accurately quoting what politicians or executives or government officials are telling them, they're writing nonsense because they have no knowledge of what's underneath. All they can tell you is what they've been told.
And whose fault is that?
Well, I think it's partly the fault, first of all, of news organizations, which, after all, are run to make a profit. And even the ones that have had historically large budgets and paid well are still focused on yesterday and don't have a lot of context. Secondly, I think that there's been a tremendous tremendous shift in newsrooms.
Here, Johnston refers to the hiring of inexperienced journalists at the expense of more highly paid veterans.
Amateurs, in the classic meaning of that word, which was a term of respect for someone who was an expert in an area or areas of knowledge. Newsrooms now are filled overwhelmingly in the large newspapers with people who grew up in upper middle class and sometimes rich households, went to name schools. And I've literally had discussions with journalists who do not believe that anybody in New York City, for example, raises children on an income of less than $50,000 a year, much less $25,000, who've never been to poor neighborhoods, who've never gone, as I have, for example, to an all-black poor neighborhood on a Saturday night, bar to bar, trying to find somebody that I need to interview for a story. They can't imagine these things. They haven't been there. They have incredible misunderstandings of the economics of people who are poor. They don't have any real understanding of job discrimination, of the pricing mechanisms that are used that make it very difficult for poor people who work hard just to put enough food on the table for their children. And that is, these are people who come from a different background. I expect them to have those kind of views that they do because of the backgrounds that they come from.
Enrollment in journalism schools today is at an all-time high, probably largely stoked by the very kinds of people, the very backgrounds you're talking about. What are these people in for?
Well, it's a tremendously fun thing to do, okay? When I was a young man, I could have decided to go into business, and I have no doubt that I would be an extraordinarily wealthy man today had I gone into business. Okay, and now that I'm older, I have gone into business, and I'm doing okay. But it's fun, and there's a lot of freedom, and there's a cachet to it. And if you don't have to worry about your income one way or another, even if you don't have a trust fund, you have a resource that says, well, I can do this for 5 or 10 years and leave and go do something else, you're going to have a much different view of the world than if you're like me, you came from a poor background, and this was an economic step up, a huge step up in my case. Those people are being drawn in now. Many of them, journalism is not a career for them in the sense of an economic career. It's a place to go do something interesting and then go on. Of course, it's always been true that the majority of journalism students did not go into hard news. But if you pick up skills in journalism, they'll apply elsewhere. Look at the number of TV anchors who have run for political office or have gone into various kinds of business based on their celebrity.
Coming down to the bottom line, how we started talking in the first place is, what would you tell someone who was going out with the goal of becoming a career journalist today?
I've actually discouraged a lot of young people from going into journalism. If you want to do serious reporting, you better decide that you're really, really, really good, and you better establish that you are fiercely competitive, incredibly smart, that you can think outside the box, and that you can take complex issues and boil them down to simple issues that ordinary people can understand. If you've got all those skills and this burning belly that you've got to go do something, then go for it. But if you're not in that very narrow group of people, there's not going to be a place for you. So, it doesn't make sense for you to do this. And you can do some journalism as part of a different job. The world is full of college professors who write books or magazine articles and lecture, lawyers who do things on the side, other occupations.